Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Monday, November 7th, 2011. I am your host, Greg Luca, and today I am joined by two writers who are really excited that they get to cover a bowl game now. We have Matt Watts.
Yay!
And Tom Green.
Chick-fil-A bowl.
Yeah, do you guys have guesses where we'll end up at the end of the year now? It's going to be something that doesn't matter, but what are the options? What are we looking at?
It's either going to be the TaxSlayer.com Gator Bowl.
Sounds like fun.
BBVA Compass Bowl.
What's BBVA Compass?
I have no idea. But it's in Birmingham.
Oh, I don't want that one. I don't want that one.
So we'll occupy Birmingham and protest the bowl game.
So Outback is out of the picture. I can't get some onions or.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get any Outback.
The Chick-fil-A Bowl representative was at the game on Saturday against Vanderbilt. So still holding out hope that we get some free Chick-fil-A fans
in the building, and was really encouraged about offering up those tickets to the.
Well, apparently they're already sold out.
Yeah, the game's already sold out. So wait, how?
People care about the Chick-fil-A Bowl, man. They want that Chick-fil-A.
Is it like said that there's going to be an SEC team in some other school or like
how? That's how it works. Like they have contracts so every year. The Chick-fil-A Bowl. These bowls all have contracts to get an SEC team.
So who buys tickets to a game that they don't know who's going to be in?
Corporations, businesses, scalpers, et cetera, et cetera.
Fill out a whole stadium?
Yep.
All right.
Apparently.
Whatever works. Well, on today's show, we're going to talk about how Florida became bowl eligible, which was with the win over Vanderbilt. It was a fun game. We'll get into that.
Well, not technically. They still have to beat Furman, so.
Right. We became all bowl eligible because the mighty Paladins of Furman. That's great. I can't wait till we talk about the Paladins.
Yeah.
I'm never going to call it Furman. It's just going to be the Paladins on every reference. But, yeah, we're going to talk about what happened in the Vanderbilt game, kind of just go break down the whole team, and then we get into a lot of Gators in the NFL stuff. Big picture Gators in the NFL, which is always fun. We bust out our top 10, and yeah, if you have any feedback, be sure to send that to podcast@alligator.org. We always like to hear from you guys, and with that, I guess we'll just get right into it. Okay, so on Saturday, Florida beat Vanderbilt 26-21 in the Swamp. Interesting game, I guess. In some ways it was terrible, in some ways it was pretty watchable. It got kind of exciting towards the end, but before we get kind of into the nitty-gritty, overall, how important is this win for Florida? What does it mean to you guys? Was it even a good win? Like, what do you take away from this game overall, big picture?
We're going to have to cover a bowl game. That's about it. I mean, it was definitely not a great win. It wasn't an impressive win. It was a win that the team needed, the players needed, the coaching staff needed. And sure, the fans probably were glad to see it as well. But in the grand scheme of things, it was an expected win. Like, if you didn't win that game, then a lot more things were being said than they did win. You know what I mean?
What did it mean? It meant Florida didn't fall below 500. I mean, that if they lose that game, I can't even imagine how badly things would have spiraled out of control, dropping five straight, losing a team that you owned for the last 20 years. Like Walt said, it's a win they definitely needed.
Right, so it's not to you guys, and this is kind of where I'm at. It's not a good sign. It's just that they didn't fall apart, and the world's not completely over. Is that basically
right? After losing four straight, having a couple transfers, I mean, they definitely could have laid down and lost that game, and just continued the embarrassment of what this season has been, kind of. But they didn't do that, so I guess that's a positive.
Yeah, all right, kind of getting into kind of what we saw from the offense. I guess Jeff Demps was the big performer. He sort of carried things for this game. He had 158 yards and two touchdowns. What did you guys make of his performance? Was impressed, not impressed? It's just Vanderbilt. Where are we at?
I mean, it is just Vanderbilt. He had a career day for the second time this year with 157 yards against Kentucky. But between those two games, I know he was hobbled by injuries after spraining his ankle against Alabama, but he had 13 rushes for 16 or 17 yards in the month between those two games. So I guess Vandy is kind of that defense that cured Florida's run game ailments.
I mean, the two games where we've seen Jeff Demps really perform well have been against Kentucky and against Vanderbilt. So sure, he was injured, whatever. It's still just Vanderbilt to me. I don't care how improved you want to say they are. They definitely looked improved on the field, but at the end of the day, they're still recruiting athletes to Vanderbilt. It's Vanderbilt.
Right. I think what we saw on Saturday are a lot of those plays where Vanderbilt's in position and they have him bottled up, but because he's just faster, like he was against Kentucky, like he was against Tennessee and FAU and UAB, and the same thing if Rainey had been in there, is they can just make plays against those guys that they can't make against the other teams, and that's not necessarily good on them. It's just they're fast and they're athletes and the guys they're playing against aren't. Is that
right? Yeah, like the 52-yard run that kind of sealed it there in the fourth quarter.
Well, that is just a great move.
Well, yeah, yeah, but if that's Morris Claiborne or if that's Drake or Patrick or if that's somebody else on the outside, I'm not completely sold that, you know, he's going to drop the guy to his knees like that. You know what I mean? Sure, it's a great move, but also it's a vandy corner.
Right, but, I mean, less that big run and more for me, it was just the little things. Like, I remember there was a time where, you know, he gets the ball and he runs, like, and he's 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage running into his own offensive lineman. And instead of them kind of closing in and making a play, he can run back and forth and they get 8 yards on the play or whatever it is. Like, it's those ones that got me with that. Tom, did you see something similar in terms of Jeff Dempsey's performance?
Yeah, basically. So, I mean, we were sitting next to each other. We were commenting on the same thing. Like, just a few plays where it looked like Vandy should have had him for a loss of 2 or 3 yards, but he turned it into a 5-6 yard gain by, you know, just beating them to the outside, something that he couldn't do against any of those October opponents.
Yeah, and then another player that was involved in the run game, finally we saw a little bit of Mike Gillisley. He had 9 carries, 39 yards. I don't know if it lived up to the hype that everybody was building, but I guess with Rainey out, he got a couple carries. He did something with it. Were you guys impressed? Do you think we'll see more of him going forward? Because I feel like this is like the ceiling for Gillisley at this point.
I mean, I'm not willing to make any, you know, projections for Mike Gillisley's playing time going forward based on what we've seen so far this year. Not knocking Gillisley per se, just knocking the coaching staff and what they say and whether he's going to get in the game and what role he's going to play and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is with Gillisley. Like, I think the most we're ever going to see out of him is, you know, 10 carries for however many yards. He's not going to be that featured back that fans want to see him be. But he's been consistent for them, is the thing. He never lost yards when he ran the ball Saturday. He had one for no gain, but everything else, he gained positive yards. He falls forward through the piles. He doesn't, you know, run backwards.
I was actually impressed with Hunter Joyer.
Yeah, I wanted to say before you go on, I want to have kind of like a Hunter Joyer versus Trey Burton for the fullback snaps discussion in terms of where you think that's going to go and where it should go and what they bring to the table. So you were going to say something about Joyer. You can get started there.
Yeah, I mean, he actually looked quick. He took a few handoffs from the up position at fullback, and he looked quick getting through the line. He had his first 2 carries went for 16 yards. He had a 9 yard gain down inside the red zone. I think he gives you a great little wrinkle there, and I'm surprised we haven't asked about it and they haven't used him in that capacity prior to now, because he looked quick and he's a big guy. He's going to be tough to bring down, and they don't have a guy like that between the tackles. I think he's that guy for them in that type of role going forward, and they should, especially in
weekly siren,
yeah,
by the
weekly
way.
Weekly siren, obviously. When they're trying to establish that power running game that they couldn't get going in the four-game losing streak, you need a guy like Hunter Joyer because he can open up the holes when he's not carrying the ball, and he can also create a hole when he is carrying the ball.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
the way he impressed me the most, I just wanted to say before Tom, you go, was just as a lead blocker.
Yeah, oh yeah, he's blowing people up.
Because, like, he always gets a hat on somebody, and that person feels it for sure. It's a big guy, a lot of force behind
him. Yeah, as a freshman, I mean, he's still a large man. Very strong.
There's a reason that he was the number one fullback recruit in the class last year. I mean, I know, you know, people made a big deal about it when he was in high school being recruited, but dude benches like just ridiculous amounts, and he's got a low center of gravity too, so he's just going to bully some guys around out there.
And this is going to be a name that fans are going to come to know and love for the next 3 years, because this year they've got to do what they've got to do because they've got Chris Rainey and Jeff Dempse as the running backs. But next year, it's not going to be that way. They're going to get different offensive linemen in here. They're going to get different running backs, and they're going to run that power straight-ahead run game. And one of the most pivotal parts to that is a lead-blocking fullback, and that's what Hunter Joyer is going to be.
Right. He's going to be a folk hero by the time, by the time he's done at Florida.
He's definitely one of the pieces for the power running game. He's a guy that's going to factor into that. When they get it the way they want it to be, he'll be involved. One thing that kind of I thought made his role more important Saturday was the switch to the pistol formation, which it's basically not the pistol. It's just their same exact plays run with Brantley in the shotgun and the fullback set off to the side. So, I mean, a lot of people are trying to give the offense credit for their ability to adjust and kind of learn this new thing on the fly. But it's the exact same calls, just the quarterback is standing somewhere different.
Yeah.
But I think that definitely helped them establish more of a downhill running game with Brantley still unable to take snaps under center. And I think Joyer was a huge part of that. And the reason we haven't seen as much of him before now was that, at least against Georgia, they had to do a lot of the spread stuff. And that's where, I guess, Burton is actually the better fit in that. Right. Would you agree? I mean,
right.
Because he was, again, the leading receiver in this game against Vanderbilt. 3 catches, 41 yards.
Yeah, so. our personal feelings of Burton aside, he gives you a different look and a different option when he's in the game than Joyer does, for sure.
Do you think Joyer's done anything to kind of offset the balance? Because it was like it seemed like it was kind of split almost 50-50 between the two of them at the fullback spot. There were a couple plays where I saw both Burton and Joyer in there, but that was rare.
I mean, you've heard how much coaches love Trey Burton and how he just does, like, everything for them in practice. But Will Muschamp was talking today about Hunter Joyer and just how much he loves what he's brought to the team and pretty much said, like, he's been, like, our fullback all year, and he's, you know, building himself a bit of a bigger role there, and he's going to become a great player.
So, yeah, but, I mean, let's talk a little bit about Burton. Do you think he's still kind of the fullback on the passing downs? Because we haven't seen Joyer do anything in the kind of the – he's a pass protector, fine. He had to do that a couple times Saturday and was fine there. But Burton's still kind of the guy in terms of pass catching and doing some of that tight end stuff too, right? Do you still think he'll have a pretty big role even with Joyer's emergence?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some packages and some plays where it's a benefit to have Trey Burton on the field, if not from a production standpoint, at least from a deception standpoint. But in a running set, in a running play, there's no advantage to having Trey Burton on the field in front of Hunter Joyer, in my opinion.
Yeah, because he's been bad as kind of that power back.
I think. Even in media day before the season, he said the hardest thing for him in adjusting to that role is getting hit. So, I mean, that's what you've got to do in that position in a running play is be able to put your nose on somebody and not be afraid.
Right. They paint him as the running back / fullback / tight end, but I think at this point he's just a fullback, right? Like, have we seen something from him at either of these other positions that we think he should be playing there? And
I mean, I think he's like an H-back. He's not a prototypical fullback. He's right. Not anything else. He's not a runner. From a running set, in my opinion. I mean, he's done all right taking snaps from the Wildcat, but taking a handoff, ineffective. Completely ineffective.
I still don't think Trey Burton should be playing the role that he is playing on this team.
You think he's getting too much snaps as it is already?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Just because he's not fast enough or just doesn't produce enough for you? Or...
He's not very good at any one thing. He's just mediocre at a bunch of things.
Right. I think mediocre gets it done for this team, though.
Right.
Like, I don't know. I can't say that he doesn't deserve to be out there. Because who are, like, if it's like a third and seven or something, who's going to be your fullback in that? Like, I think that's where you want Burton as kind of a pass-catching option.
Yeah, because you've got him as an option as pass protection, or he can come out of the backfield and, you know, provide another outlet.
Because in terms of, like, attack options, it's Rainey, Dumps, and Gillislee, but I don't know if any of those guys, I can't speak to Gillislee in this regard, but in terms of, like, pass protection, I don't know how they fare, because
right.
Dumps and Rainey just aren't big enough to... You know,
and I don't think Gillislee knows the protection.
Yeah,
he's told
us that he's had, like, that was the hardest thing for him learning this new offense, the pass protection, which is probably part of the reason why he doesn't get more snaps.
Right, we're talking a little bit about pass protection. Let's talk about the passing game. Brantley was 16 of 24 for 173 yards. I thought he was good. I voted him to be one of the swamp studs. You guys didn't think he deserved it.
You're also insane.
What did you guys make of Brantley's game?
I mean, he's looking better. You know, he looked a little healthier than he did against Georgia. Obviously, he looked a little more mobile. He only got sacked once. He actually got some protection this time. But I mean, he was good, but he wasn't great. I don't think he deserved a swamp stud.
The swamp studs are, you know, that's, you have to be some serious. You have to do some serious work to get a swamp stud. So that's fair.
Brantley did what was asked of him, and he did it well. I mean, he's not going to be that guy to make the big play for you. He threw an accurate ball. He got the ball out of his hand, got it to receivers in space. Brian Holt told us they were going to work the middle of the field. So
that turned out to be
inside
very
sources.
Accurate.
But yeah, I think the telling thing about that is for me the two biggest plays of the game made by a quarterback were made by Jacoby Brissett and not John Brantley, and that would be on the first series, where he had a guy draped all over him, hanging on his ankle, and he completed the pass to Amarius Hines.
I mean,
that should have been a touchdown.
Brantley, that's
right.
Fine, too.
But I don't think Brantley's going to keep the play alive that long to make that play.
Amarius Hines was wide open the whole time.
Right. But
Brantley probably would have just got it to him sooner. So, I mean, it wouldn't have looked this flashy, but I think he could have had the same results.
And then
there.
The play in the fourth quarter where Brissett scrambles to his right off, and he's about to run out of bounds, and he chalks it up to Frankie Hammond. Yeah. It's called for a pass interference.
Which you could argue is pretty stupid.
Yeah, but we're saying Brantley throws that ball away.
Which might Brissett have been the right decision.
Yeah, yeah, but if Brantley's in the game and he throws that away, Florida doesn't get that first down.
That's fair.
Vanderbilt gets the ball back.
They get the 52-yard touchdown. Yeah. Vanderbilt gets the ball back. It's a whole different change. It's a whole different ball game.
That's definitely
so
true.
So the two biggest plays for me of the game were those two, and they were made by Brissett, not
right.
Brantley.
I mean, did Brissett show you anything else in terms of that'll make you confident for him going forward, maybe even next year? Is that he show you anything else in that regard that way, or is it just, you know, a couple of good plays and that's all we take away?
Well, right now he's still a freshman. He's still not going to be asked to do that much, but he still led them on the scoring drive that won the game, essentially.
That's fair.
So,
Tom, your thoughts on Brissett?
I mean, I feel like he's looking a little more confident and comfortable in that offense. He looked a little shaky the first couple times out, overthrowing some balls, getting picked off. But he just looks like he knows what he's doing out there more. Like, he has a better grasp of the offense.
Right. He basically threw two passes in the game, so he can't read that much into it. But, yeah. And then he had the touchdown run, so woohoo for him, the one-yard sneak. But, kind of moving into the receivers a little bit. There's still nothing
receivers?
There, right? Jordan Reed made a couple catches over the middle. That's cool.
Dunbar had a couple catches on the outside for maybe 12 yards.
9 yards.
Like, do we have there's nothing else to say, really, right?
No, Frankie
Hammond did a good job getting interfered on that play at the end of the game.
Well, I mean, I guess this is probably very much matchup-based, but they ran it 46 times and they passed it 25 times. I think that's beyond the ideal balance you'd like to have, but I think if they can get away with doing that, that's the way they want to play football, right? You guys agree that's kind of what they're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, they want to hold the clock. Because they know their strength is not offense. I mean, they just need to get a lead, hold the clock, run the running game, and dictate to the other team.
Especially to do that without Rainey, too. What were you going to say?
Yeah, you heard Muschamp after the game. He was like, y'all know me. We're going to run the ball.
Right.
And now that they're finally actually able to move the ball running it, you know, go for it. If you can run it, run it.
I think having Rainey out might actually have helped them in that regard.
You think?
Maybe. I mean, Dimps has a more straight-ahead style than Rainey does. I mean, he still likes to move laterally at some times, but for the most part, he's looking downhill.
I guess. I think Rainey could have made some plays against Vanderbilt, though. I think
he definitely would have made some plays, but he also has a lot of plays that go for negative or no gain, whereas Dimps would pick up 3-4, which sets up your mediocre offense for a much, much more manageable third down opportunity than 3rd-and-8, 3rd-and-10, 3rd-and-15, which is a lot of the cases when Rainey's in the game. And he tries to take a sweep to the outside and, you know, loses 6 or something.
Right. And then, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the last thing I want to talk about on offense is kind of the fourth down decision where they drew the guy offsides. It was 4th and inches. They were on their own 15. A couple minutes left in the game, and Vanderbilt had all the momentum. They were only down by a score at that point. And basically what happened was Trey Burton lined up, and I'm not sure whether they were going to go for it on 4th and 1 or 4th and inches, but drew the guy offsides. They didn't have to. What did you guys think about that situation? Is that a spot where you would have gone for it? Because Muschamp said after the game that they were going to go for it and that they
he's either lying or absolutely insane.
Well, which one? Because I don't think he's lying there. I don't think you have any reason.
Right, I agree with you. I think he's insane.
Because didn't they have a play, the play where Brissett tried to draw a guy offsides and it didn't work? And like, didn't they admit at some point? Like, there's no reason to lie about that after the game, whether you were or weren't going to go for it, that I could see.
Yeah, that was against Auburn, I believe.
Right.
Right.
See, here's one thing I'll say. That in all the rushing they did that we just talked about, in Dempsey's 23 carries, only one went for a loss. Gills' 9 carries, none went for a loss. Joyer's 3 carries, none went for a loss. And Burton's 4 carries, only one went for a loss. I think they actually thought that they could line up and almost assuredly get there. And I'm not sure they wouldn't have gone for it, but that's a really bad decision.
I agree with what you're saying, but every instinct of coaching, I don't care who you are at any level, you don't go for it on 4th down inside your own 20-yard line.
I mean, Belichick,
in a one-score game, no less.
You saw that with Belichick and the Colts, what was it, 3 years ago? Absolutely insane. You try and throw a swing pass.
If Belichick can do it, then Muschamp can do it. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Like, I mean, and he caught a lot of flack for that, and it had a lot of bad repercussions for that Patriots team that year. You don't do that type of stuff. It's absolutely insane. It's Sure, it's saying you have confidence in your offense, but it's also saying I don't trust my defense right now.
Right, and here's why I think they were going for it is because when they want to draw people off sides, they've done this a few times this season. They put Brissett in there because I don't know if there's something about
he's allowed. That's why, like, I was telling Tom last night, I thought Brissett was the man under center during that play, even though I wrote it down in my notes as standing on the sideline as Burton.
The fact that he wasn't,
they were trying
that...
to draw him off sides. That's why I thought it was Brissett.
So do you think that, like, if the guy doesn't go off sides, do they run a play there?
I mean, I think they've got a check, but I don't think they run a play. I think they either take the delay game or they call a timeout.
Tom?
Yeah, I can't in good conscience think that they were going to run a play. Like,
well, what about
it just
in bad conscience?
Me.
Like, I don't think it's a good idea either, but I think
it just
they were
baffles
do
me
it.
That anybody would run a fourth down play inside your own 15 with a one score game and your defense shows no signs of being able to stop the opposing
that's
offense.
That's the exact reason you do go for it.
Yeah, that's why they went for it.
Because they have the defense has shown no signs of being able to stop them, so you can't punt it.
But you want to give them the ball at the 15-yard line?
You want to keep the ball, because they're going to score regardless, because you can't stop them.
Right, that's Muschamp's philosophy. He's not thinking, oh, what if we don't get this? He's thinking, we're going to get this. That's why I'm going for it.
Right, because it's like they...
He's not the guy that has those other thoughts, I don't think.
They rarely slowed Vanderbilt down in the second half. So I think they actually might have gone for it and tried to get that inch.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think they probably would have, but it's insane to me to even think about it.
Right. Anything else to go over on the offense, guys? The Brissett throw, the one that ended in the pass interference, that we talked about it a little bit. I mean, that play, that decision, the throw itself, were you guys kind of like...
I mean, in hindsight, it's like a great play by him, but I don't, like, as it's unfolding,
I guess they had one-on-one down there, and there was
one-on-one on the safety.
It was a zone coverage play for Vanderbilt because they just had that guy out there.
It was a broken play by that point, though. I mean, it was just kind of like, oh, you see the quarterback scrambling, so he takes off down the sideline.
But couldn't you see this as a scenario where, like, Brissett throws it up and he gets picked, and then everybody's like, this guy's the biggest idiot ever.
Right, for sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, hindsight not being 20/20, is that smart throw, or should they have thrown it away? Like,
you, of course, you say... The way it resulted, it was the right play because you get the pass interference, you get the first down, you get the 52-yard touchdown run from Dems two plays later, whatever it was. But, I mean, if you don't have that play, you don't win the game, I don't think. So, I don't think you can go back and micromanage this and say that was a bad throw.
Well, because we talk a lot about Brissett's, like, decisions, and if that's something people are going to be looking at going into next
year.
But
that's just his mentality, is to extend the play as long as possible and try to make something happen because he's a freshman.
So they're not even going to – you don't think they're going to try to coach that kind of thing out of him? They're just going to let him be
I think they're going to coach that out of him to a degree, but not in that situation. I think at that situation, your quarterback's trying to make a play to win the game.
So when they
it's
watch
third
the film
– and eight, and if you don't get a first down there, you're giving the ball back to Vanderbilt with all the momentum, and they're likely going to score at least a field goal, probably a touchdown.
So when they sit down with Charlie Weiss and they watch the film, Charlie Weiss is going to say, good job, nice throw, way to take a shot?
No, I think he's going to say, that worked out, but...
Tom?
Yeah, I don't think it was a smart play. Like I was saying before, if Brantley's in the game, he throws that ball away. He doesn't force that throw and possibly get it picked off.
So, right, that's, I guess, the overall point is they came really close to losing this game in a lot of different ways.
Well, there's that, and then there's also the stuff on defense.
Right, yeah. That's a good way to kind of transition over to defense. We talked, there's a couple, let's see, the Saunders pass interference
and
was the
two,
one that jumped out to
two
me.
Two on Jalen Watkins, that should have been called.
Right.
One in the end zone and then one down on the sideline where he just had his arm draped around the guy's hip.
And even with all that, Jordan Rodgers was 19 of 28 for 297 yards and two touchdowns.
And a rushing touchdown.
220 of those in the second half.
Right.
I'm pretty sure he was like 70% in the second half with three total touchdowns.
Right. So 14
or 19.
So what's going on with the secondary? Why? How did this guy just from Vanderbilt just carve
that's wild the pass interference calls came about or should have been called is because they were getting absolutely torched. Like Jordan Rodgers was doing a very good impression of his older brother.
And this Jordan Matthews guy had nine catches for 170 yards.
Yeah, they could not stop him. It started on the first series when he beat Marcus Roberson 1-on-1 down the sideline. Roberson had his left hand
he was just holding it. I watched that replay.
And then just pulled in
and
to grab with
Matthews
one arm.
Matthews grabs with one arm. And
right, they're cheating.
Right.
They can't even help.
They cheat and they can't even, right.
I mean, so... It was everybody, right? There was no... I mean, Elam was...
Coming into this game, I thought Roberson was pretty good. I mean, he had decent coverage on the play, apart from holding Matthew's hand on that first play in the first series. And it was a great throw. I mean, there's no defense for a great throw. And Rodgers had a lot of great throws in the afternoon, but still, there was a lot of mistakes from that secondary. And you're right, it was across the board. There wasn't one guy that you can say, hey, he played well.
I would say
Matt Elam included,
well.
No.
Why not?
He blew the coverage on the touchdown and then.
No, that was Pop Saunders that blew the coverage on the Jordan Rodgers' first touchdown.
I'm talking about on the zone coverage, to where it was the pass to Matthews in the left side of the end zone.
That was Pop Saunders that blew that coverage.
It's always Saunders. I think he's terrible.
But there was three guys that were all like, oh, and they converge after the play, and you're like, oh wow, that was obviously a blown coverage.
Because I don't remember ever seeing Elam nearby when it kind of thing. So maybe he should have been nearby. But the point is, like, he was never the nearest man that kind of, it was man coverage and he wasn't on him close enough, or it was his zone and he wasn't making a play. To my eye. Tom, what did you see in that regard, Elam?
I thought he was of the DBs, he played the best. But
wait, you guys won't even say he had a good game?
I mean, he did make good plays in the run.
Right.
He had three tackles for a loss.
You factor that in.
he almost made a very great play on Vandy's first possession when he almost picked off a swing pass.
And he did make the deflection. He did.
Yeah.
Right. Well, who's their coverage safety? Who's Florida's coverage safety?
It would have to be, I mean, Elam's the best coverage safety, but they don't have a true coverage safety.
Which is my point, which is why Elam plays in the nickel a lot, up by the line of scrimmage. I don't understand, like, everybody wants to put all this praise on Elam as a great safety. He's a great nickel corner.
Well, I mean, is Troy Polamalu a great safety? That's how they use him. It's not like he can't do it, that's just where they put him.
That's a good point, but I don't see Elam as being this great player that everybody wants to make him out to be. I think he looks good by virtue of all of the terribleness that he's surrounded by.
So on a good defense, he wouldn't stand out?
No.
I don't know. I guess I'd have to see this to make that argument one way or the other, but he has definitely stood out on this unit to my eyes.
Just, agreed.
I mean, this isn't a bad defense. They're still...
It's pretty bad.
I mean, there are weaknesses in there, obviously.
I don't really
care
that they're, like, 22nd in points allowed or something. Like, you just watch them play football, and they're not good at it. Like, yeah. I don't... The line does teams that they completely overmatch, which is some of them, and that's going to help statistically.
Do you have the numbers in front of you? What are they ranked in the SEC in sacks?
I have the SEC packet. We can dig through it. While I'm doing that, just, like, I don't know, talk about anything else.
It's just, like, Muschamp even said after the game that the coverage issues towards the end of the game, a lot of that falls on the defensive line because they're not getting pressure. If you can't get pressure with four guys against Vanderbilt's diminutive, small, undersized offensive line, then you've got problems.
Tied for eighth with 16 sacks.
Yeah, that's absurd. 16 sacks?
I'm surprised they have that many.
On the season?
I'm surprised they have that many.
Ronald
Powell has four sacks. When did that happen?
Right.
Somebody stuffed
his stat sheet.
He had one Saturday.
One
against Vanderbilt. And then he had one against Tennessee, and I think he probably had another one in the first game.
Because he's bad, and William Green is bad, and Earl Okine is Earl Okine.
Don't pressure the quarterback. And everybody loves to jump all over Dominic Easley and say he's so great because he talks trash after a play and gets pulled down and blah, 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 blah.
I legitimately thought he was going to get into a fight on Saturday.
He's not a consistent pressure.
Right, and I think it's tough against the mobile guys like a Jordan Rodgers because players like Easley and Floyd and, you know, Howard, their game is more collapsing the pocket. And when these guys can get outside the tackles, they're helpless.
Okay. But that still doesn't change the fact that Dominic Easley is not performing up to the level where everybody wants to play.
Well, the first couple games, he was a lot better than he has been the last couple. That's for sure.
I know Ronald Powell had a sack Saturday, but I didn't even, like, notice him out there. I feel like that's been the case for a lot of games.
Right, that was the one play where I'm like, oh, there's Ronald Powell making a play.
Yeah,
wow.
I mean, he made a couple plays against the run. I don't have his
tackles. He had a couple
right
tackles
here,
for a loss.
Just, he had a few tackles. I mean, we've been over how he's a disappointment, and those other guys they've done some stuff that's good, and they play the run fairly well. That's what I'll give you guys that. If you want to say they're a good defense, that's against the run, that's fine.
They got gashed by, like, all October.
By Trent Richardson. And, like, the Dyer, they did not get gashed against Auburn. That's not fair to say.
I don't think they got gashed against Auburn. That's
they just didn't have a good performance.
Like, Georgia was okay. Like, they
LSU
didn't,
gashed
they didn't
them.
Kill them. LSU, yeah.
Two
like,
guys pretty much
so
had career days.
Two best teams in college football. They didn't look great.
And a lot of the other two were the fact that the offense couldn't do anything in the
right.
Same
if
pass,
a guy has like 800 carries,
down,
he's
right.
going
to
get some yards.
Yeah, there was 60 carries to 25 passes in all those four losses.
Right. So okay, it's not an outstanding unit, but I think it's very good. Like if you look at where that ranking comes from in terms of their whatever they are in the nation,
the
that's a pretty good
job,
number. It's the run
for the
game.
Most part, is to put the offense in a position to win the game. And the defense has done that pretty much throughout the entire season. For the most part, like you saw it against Georgia, two fumbles inside your own territory set up two quick change, sudden change situations, and two touchdowns. That's been the problem for the defense all years. They've been getting screwed. They haven't been dealt a fair shake. So, I mean, I agree with you. They're a lot better than we're giving them credit for right. sure.
And then
Jay Howard, for me, is the guy on that defensive line. He's just a man.
Yeah.
He should be a top first two rounds pick this in the draft for me, without a doubt.
I could see that. I don't know. I'd have to take a
I'm not saying first round, but he should be in the top 75 players chosen out of this crop of defensive tackles.
You heard him today when he was asked what he credits his productivity this season to.
He's not taking any
classes. He's just doing an internship.
Yeah,
so imagine him when he doesn't have to worry about a class or internship at the pro level where he could just focus all of his energy.
From an NFL weight program, yeah. I mean, Jay Howard's, yeah.
Right, and we had a little bit of a shakeup in the linebackers for this game. Mike Taylor started for Jelani Jenkins, who had a concussion and didn't play, and then Kitchens started for McCray. Is that how that worked out? Because I guess he wasn't very good, because I don't even remember who started. Like, right. He didn't stand out to me. But Mike Taylor was okay. He missed a couple tackles. What did you guys make of his performance? He led the Gators with 7 tackles in the game. Tom, you got something on Mike Taylor? What did you see from him?
He was all right.
Yeah, I mean, it's been the same kind of thing throughout the season. Is none of the linebackers have really stood out. And made you say, wow, look at that. Like, well, look at that play.
I feel like through the first month of the season, Jelani really stood out.
A little bit.
Because he was dropping interceptions.
No, but he was playing well. He was playing well outside of that. But after the first month of the season, we were all saying, if Jelani could catch, he'd be like one of the top linebackers in the nation right now.
Right, because he makes a good amount of tackles. But I think taking a closer look, like, when I watched the game Saturday, every time there was, like, a big hit or a guy got, like, pushed back or something where I was like, wow, who did that? It was Mike Taylor, usually. Like, right. He flattened a couple people. And
he's a freshman. He's got that nasty streak that none of the other guys have.
Right.
Like, they haven't had a guy like a Channing Crowder or Brandon Spikes on this team for a minute. I think that's what they've been missing. For a minute.
We talk about downhill running. I think he's a downhill linebacker.
No, definitely.
And that's what I like about
Mike
him.
Taylor for sure.
So
he's got a bright future. He's a little smaller, but in the way that they run scheme on defense, he should be able to find a role for sure.
Right, and we've kind of bounced around with the defense a little bit, a less regimented show this week. But getting back to the secondary quickly, is there one guy that stands out as the weakest link? Because we have the guys out there. We're not counting Elam. We like Elam. But the other guys we can consider, like Saunders, Evans, Watkins, Roberson, all looked pretty bad. Is there one of those four that stands out to you as the worst?
For me, it's between Evans and Saunders.
Yeah, I would have
to agree. Saunders got pulled from the starting job and replaced by Evans, and Evans isn't... I mean, there's a reason why Evans didn't win the job.
And when they use Elam in the nickel, they're both out there sticking it up.
Right.
Like, Tom, do you have a take either way? Who's the worst? Who's the worst guy?
I mean...
Saunders has been getting abused the most.
Yes, Saunders looked bad.
He gave up one of the fourth down touchdowns to Georgia. I mean,
he blew the coverage on the first Jordan Rodgers touchdown. He got away with a blatant pass interference call.
Somebody was way not where they're supposed to be.
Right.
I don't know if that was that play on him, and if we're thinking about the same thing.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. They were somewhere. They seemed just way
He was, like, off. Down by the, like, 5 or 6 yard line while the...
Yeah, guys in the end zone, like, on the seam. Yeah. Watkins, do we have anything on him? What do you guys think? Like, because he kind of came in for Riggs. I don't know if something's wrong with Riggs. They wouldn't tell us, but...
I don't know if it's something wrong with Riggs as well as he's just not that good of a player.
But I felt like he's better than what we've seen from Watkins.
He's also 5'8", though.
Watkins isn't that much bigger.
Watkins is 5... Was he listed? I think he's listed at 5'11".
Maybe, like... But anyway, either way, like, neither one of them is, like, a big corner, and neither one of them has really played that well, but
6 feet.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, I mean... If that's something that they think helps them, but if you can't play football that well, I don't know how much that's really worth. But, yeah, I guess so. I mean, Saunders, here's the thing that I'll say about when we talk about, like, Matt Elam and you don't think he's very good in coverage, he makes up for it by some of the run stuff he can do. I haven't seen Saunders as a factor in the run game either. He's kind of just out there. Do you guys anything I haven't?
He's standing next to him on the field after the game on Saturday. He's smaller than I expected. And he's also a true freshman. I mean,
that's
guys.
That's fair. I mean, we got to give them a little
guys
bit
are
of
playing,
a break.
You know, undersized. I mean, they're undersized and they're underclassmen, and they're playing in the SEC. And I mean, I just think that by virtue of them playing for Florida and, you know, coming in as a 4-star by whoever's BS website, we automatically think they're supposed to be good. You know what I mean? And I think we hold them to a higher standard than we should. They're true freshmen, and they're not that good. And I think that's what we have to really realize.
Right, here. But Evans has no excuse, right?
No, Evans has no excuse.
All right, just want to make sure. One thing I want to touch on, penalties. Only three.
And one of them came, you know, at the end of the game when it was kind of questionable, the Bostic play. So
Questionable. Did you watch the replay on that? He was, like, all over the receiver.
Bostic questioned it. That's all that matters.
Yeah, right. It was questionable.
Somebody questioned it, so it's questionable. But, yeah, they had one or two that was declined, right?
They had one that was declined, a holding call.
On Xavier Nixon.
Yeah.
So three for 17 could have been 4 for 27, but that's still very good weather.
Right. Still and half those are on Xavier Nixon.
And then you look, Vanderbilt is 12 for 106. That was a huge factor in the game. Because, like, when you come in, coming into this game, we kind of talked about how Vanderbilt has the better athletes, and Florida has Florida has the better athletes, and for that reason, they should be able to handle Vanderbilt pretty easily. And the way that they wouldn't be able to do that, or one thing that would be a huge factor in an upset, would be if Florida shot themselves in the foot with things like turnovers and things like penalties. And they didn't do that, and I think that's a big reason why they won.
No, definitely. I mean, it's not – I think you said this yesterday – you can't win a game by not committing penalties, but you could certainly lose a game by committing penalties. And that's what, I mean, they didn't lose games by committing penalties in the losing streak, but they certainly, you know, further helped themselves lose. if that makes any sense. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't give themselves any opportunity to win by the virtue of their penalties that they were having. Because it's not just that they had a lot of penalties, it's that their penalties were dumb, bonehead, you know, in the worst possible situation to have a penalty, that's when they would have a penalty. And that's what Vandy did this game, especially the 4th and 1, the jumping off sides. I mean, Florida was also the beneficiary of not having those, you know, two pivotal penalties called against them, the pass interference calls.
So, yeah. I was going to say, I don't think Florida played that much cleaner than they have in past games. I just think that they didn't get called for a few penalties that they had been getting called for before.
Yeah, they got some home cooking.
Like, right.
Well, the lowest number coming into this game was 4 penalties, and that was against Alabama at home. And then they go on the road to LSU, on the road to Auburn, and then a neutral site in Georgia, and they just stink it up.
Well, to get called for 14 for 106 against Georgia and then turn around and be 3 for 17 in this game, that's more than just bad calls, you know? Like, you're at a certain point, you actually are making an improvement.
But
they just had a big game. Muschamp said he's not ready to say that they're now a disciplined team or anything.
But,
like,
I mean, you factor in that holding call that Vanderbilt declined, then the 3 what we all thought were obvious pass interference calls that went uncalled, that's 7 penalties for 70-something yards.
That's fair.
That's still not good.
Their average. Their average was 9 coming into the game. That's for 70-something yards.
But I don't know, maybe there's missed calls in the other games that could have made those even worse. I still think it's an improvement.
Right, it's definitely an improvement. Earl Okun said that it was a big emphasis in practice this week.
Freaking Earl Okun. We're talking about Earl Okun.
Yeah,
anyway.
We're doing it.
last thing I think I have for the game, they got in the red zone and they scored 2 touchdowns. It was the first red zone touchdown since Kentucky in the first quarter. I mean, did they show you something there, or is it the matchup thing?
I don't think they made it to the red zone in the losing streak, though.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that was a factor earlier in the season when they could get there frequently and not score, and it was still a factor when they couldn't get there frequently and they didn't score. So, was there any encouraging signs about the red zone offense? I guess that factors into the downhill run game stuff.
Right. I mean, I think the fact that helped them out in that regard is that Charlie Weiss seemed to get a lot more people involved in this game. Like, there was plays being called to pretty much every skill position player on offense. You know, everybody, you name it, had at least a target during the game. And most people, I mean, how many different receivers caught receptions? I think it was at least 7 or 8 guys caught receptions in the game. So I think that helps you in the red zone when you got 9 different guys caught a pass. So you got all the different options that you have to pay attention to in the red zone. And then they add Hunter Joyer running the ball downhill from shotgun. That was another good look.
Because here's what I'll say. I was terrified of their red zone prospects after the Gerald Christian transfer. Because I think he's the blocking tight end, and he's a guy that makes a big difference in that regard. So it's encouraging to see that without him, they even managed to improve. Obviously, it's only 2 possessions, and it's against Vanderbilt. But it wasn't the detriment I expected it might be. So that's worth something, at least.
But let me ask you this. Going forward, if you had to take Vandy's skill position players or Florida's skill position players, who would you choose?
Vandy's.
Backs and receivers, kind of?
Backs, receivers, quarterback.
Vandy's.
Ooh, I would take Vandy's quarterback, I think. Which is just weird, but he looked, I mean, I probably shouldn't judge off one game. I haven't seen a lot of Vanderbilt before that, but on that game alone, Rodgers was better. And I don't know. I think Florida's backs are better. The Vanderbilt receivers.
Zach, you think Florida's backs are better than Zach Stacy?
Yeah, yeah. I would rather have Demps, Gillisley, Joyer, Burton, and Rainey than Zach Stacy.
I'd rather have Zach Stacy over Chris Rainey.
Okay, but you got to factor in the other four guys.
I agree there, but I'm just saying, Zach Stacy.
Zach Stacy ran 13 times for 49 yards. He's no superstar.
He's also running behind a tiny offensive line against Florida. His defense, who we just said, was pretty good against the run.
Right.
But coming into the game, he led the SEC among starting running backs with 7.3 per carry.
And Florida's receivers are so bad.
He's also 200 pounds and kind of lower. He would do well in a power run.
Help that red zone thing we're talking about.
And right, exactly. And then you got Jordan Matthews, who obviously is better than any receiver that Florida can throw out there.
The fact that we're talking about it is the biggest concern.
Right, that's the
that
thing.
Anybody should
that's
come away with. I don't care if I decide that's Florida's why, guys are marginally better. Right. They should be blowing Vanderbilt out in this
that's
category, and they just aren't.
That's the point.
Okay, last thing I have in terms of a game recap is the special teams. One that jumped out to me, Caleb Sturgis, 55-yard field goal. Yay,
it was actually the second longest football in college this season.
And, like, we know he's good.
Second longest football?
I mean, field goal.
We know he's a good player. Getting him back is a boost, I guess. Like, he's better than the backup kicker.
Plus, we know you don't like kickers.
Yeah, this is silly. I mean, if you don't have Caleb Sturgis, you don't win that game. If you don't get those 6 points, you don't win the game.
The 3 points he got on the super long one are not going to be had any other way. But he missed a field goal, and he made a 40-yarder. I like to think the backup kicker could go one of two.
If you have Alabama's
kicker,
you lose
Alabama,
that game.
Did you watch Alabama-LSU?
Yeah, those kicks were mondo.
What I'm trying to say here is Caleb Sturgis is way more valuable than you give him credit for. There's NFL kickers that can't make it from 55. Watching the Baltimore-Pittsburgh game last night, Billy Cundiff, a professional kicker, says, oh, my range is 53. Caleb Sturgis went out there on a bum leg and drilled it from 55.
He's good, dude. I don't have any problems with him.
I'm just saying, if you don't have Caleb Sturgis in that game, you're not winning.
Which is why Watts put him in his swamp studs.
Exactly.
I don't know if I can get on board with that. Like, they wouldn't win the game.
They don't win the game without Caleb Sturgis.
They don't win the game without Jacoby Brissett.
Well, okay. Well, no, because it's... No. Because they went for two and didn't make it, so it's 7 points.
Either way.
They would have been okay. They would have just kicked the extra point and they would have won anyway. They would have been good. Like, I'm not worried about Caleb Sturgis. To his credit, he had a good game, and that's a great kick. I mean, I don't have anything against him. I have against the position, and I think among guys doing what he's doing, he's among the best for sure, and he's going to be
I just wish
on
he didn't
the
have the health
watch list
for his own personal benefit, because I feel like he could have a chance at the next level.
I think he still does.
I mean, I'm not taking it away from him, but I think he would be a lot more sure of a prospect.
But the fact that he has like a year of eligibility left too, he could come back next year and do something crazy, or he could pull a Blair Walsh, who, like, you know, he was one of the best kickers in the nation last year, and we saw against Georgia how terrible he is. So.
Right.
It's a fickle position, so. But another thing, Florida's return game—they did pretty well again. I mean, Demps is still Demps; he's good back there, and it looks like they let him get the two returns that I have on the stat sheet here, which is something that I questioned coming into the week because obviously he had the long return, but they've done DeBoa's back there; they've done some other things. So,
I think the most impressive return of the day was Willie Green's 13-yard kickoff return.
I mean, I would wager that's the first return of his career.
And they
I
were also,
the archives.
You know, kind of pooching the kick to try and keep it away. They knew that Florida's, you know, kick return game was dominant.
Right.
So they were doing things to try and neutralize
so
that.
So Demps is the guy you guys think? He's going to be the kick returner going forward?
I mean,
as long as he's healthy.
Not.
All right. Anything else we got on special teams? The hands team made a big play on that onside kick.
John Bostic did.
Yeah, well, Jordan Reed made the catch, secured the game. Yay for him. He jumped. That's what he likes to do. He caught the ball. So, yeah, I mean.
What's Deontay Thompson doing on the hands team?
That was very funny. I guess they ran out of receivers and they just had to throw him out there. But
like, I think everybody had a chuckle looking at that. Like, Deontay Thompson.
I would just kick it right at Deontay Thompson. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like that scene from The Waterboy.
You got to pick out the weak link and just fire it at him.
But, that's bad coaching on Andy's part.
Yeah, so, I mean, the kick return game was strong. Christie's still the punter.
Cool. I wasn't impressed by his two punts.
I didn't even think about it, but the
average 37 yards. I mean, after what we saw from him the first time out there.
It was windy and chilly.
I can be back.
Yeah, true.
All right, we got to stop. We're talking about the plunder. Yeah. Natural starting point, unlike last week when I thought the natural starting point was Reggie Nelson, is obviously Tim Tebow. Was 10 of 21 for 124 yards and 2 touchdowns, which is a 56.8 rating. I guess they don't like the yards per attempt and completion percentage that much, but 2 touchdowns and no picks looks good. And then ran 12 times for 117 yards. I don't know if either of you got a chance to watch Tebow.
Not really.
But, I mean, you know, people said good things. It's kind of encouraging that he would put up decent numbers, but he still has to get better. In the terms of reading the field and being a total play, like a total quarterback and, you know, the audibles and all the stuff that goes into that. But, I mean, 117 yards on the ground is always nice.
I mean, John Fox was smart. He was calling running plays for Tebow against the league's worst run defense.
Right. Okay, so I want to talk about Joe Hayden again.
Yay, Tebow!
Joe Hayden. He's very, very good.
He's decent.
He had 7 tackles, and I forget which team they were playing, but I counted in the wide receivers only had 3 catches. So that's pretty good if you can hold wide receivers to 3 catches for a whole game.
That was all Joe Hayden.
Well, I mean, he's very good.
Cleveland actually does have the number one ranked pass defense in the NFL.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And Joe Hayden's a big part of that.
There was a lot of touchdowns for Gators in the NFL. David Nelson had 4 catches for 36 yards and a touchdown. Andre Caldwell had 5 catches for 22 yards and a touchdown. And it was, what's his name? Jabbar Gaffney had 4 catches for 40 yards and a touchdown. And Aaron Hernandez had 4 catches for 35 yards and a touchdown.
For all the flack that people have spewed Florida's way for not having receivers make it in the NFL after, you know, just balling out at Florida, these guys have kind of made some nice, respectable careers for themselves.
Right, there's some solid players in that I just listed off. And Hernandez is dynamic.
Because there's a lot of guys that come into the league more hyped than them that are out in 2 years. And these guys have at least Jabbar Gaffney and Caldwell, have made a pretty long career for themselves. And I'm proud of them.
Yeah, Jabbar Gaffney's in, what, his 9th, 10th year?
I mean, like 15th or something. Yeah. I don't know. He's really old.
Does he still got beads in his hair? Because that'd be awesome.
I highly doubt it, but I haven't seen Jabbar Gaffney in a while.
He's got the short hair.
Or was that Chad Jackson with the Patriots?
That was Chad Jackson had the braids with the beads.
Yeah. I forgot about him.
Braids with the beads, yeah.
Florida's last 1,000-yard receiver.
Carlos Dunlap had 3 tackles, but he had 2 sacks. 2 sacks for Carlos Dunlap. Now it's 3 on the year, so he's picking it up
as
a lead.
A lot of people are high on him. I mean, he hasn't put up the numbers this year, but I think he had
9 last year as a rookie.
Reggie Nelson had 4 tackles, cool on him. And the Pittsburgh Steelers offensive line once again started 3 guys, with Marcus Gilbert at right tackle, Marquise Pouncey at center, and Max Starks at left tackle. And I had a couple friends who watched this game, and they reported to me that all 3 of them played pretty well, and that pass protection for Big Ben was very good throughout the night.
You're so enamored with that.
It's cool. Because it's a good team, and the offensive line was so bad, and the University of Florida had single-handedly saved it. All right, so we kind of breezed through kind of the game-by-game stuff this week because I wanted to get you guys to weigh in. In the office last night, myself and John Booth, who you might remember from the Small Sports Podcast, kind of ranked our top 10 Gators in the NFL, kind of in terms of this season and in terms of what they've done in their career and just in terms of who are the best players at this point. So we had Aaron Hernandez at 1, Marquise Pouncey at 2, Joe Hayden at 3, Percy Harvin number 4, Reggie Nelson number 5. Really? You don't like Reggie Nelson?
He shouldn't be in the top 50. He's terrible.
He's been really good.
He's had a great season. No,
he has like 50 tackles.
Just because you have this bias for what he did while he was in a Jags uniform doesn't mean you should take away
from
what
he's doing this year. Do you watch Reggie Nelson play?
Hold on. Who would you put above him? We have Mike Pouncey 6, David Nelson 7.
Mike Pouncey would be above him. David Nelson would be above him. Jabbar Gaffney would be above him. Tim Tebow would be above him.
Carlos Dunlap 9.
Dunlap would be above him.
Brandon Spikes 10.
Brandon Spikes shouldn't even be on the list either. Jeremy Mincy should be on that list.
You think because he's a Jaguar?
No, because he's a quality player. And these are – Reggie Nelson is not a quality player. You guys just look at a stat sheet and see, oh, he's got these tackles. He's playing well.
He's been good this year.
Bonkers! No, he is not good.
How many times did you watch the Bengals?
Jason Hill, he's the most terrible starting wide receiver in the league, had a 75-yard touchdown because Reggie Nelson blew the coverage. Every single week, Reggie Nelson blows an easy coverage to give up a huge touchdown.
You don't watch every Bengals game. Don't even pretend to tell me you watch all the Bengals
games. I follow stuff on Twitter, and I follow the stats. It's unbelievable that you think Reggie Nelson
is good. You just said you follow the stats right after you told us the stats don't matter. He has 50 tackles this year. He can have 100 tackles this season.
He's not good. not good.
Okay, well, aside from Reggie Nelson, our top 10.
I don't think Aaron Hernandez should be one.
I think it's between him, Pouncey, and Hayden. I could go either way.
Yeah, those three I feel right. like are interchangeable right now.
I mean,
it just depends on if Hernandez is healthy or not.
It's just the current crop of Gators in the NFL are still young, so it's kind of tough to rank them for me. Reggie Nelson should not be on the list, though. Should okay. not.
All right. All right. Well, we had Tebow 8. How do you guys feel about that? Because he's one that's tough to rank because we don't really know at this point. But yeah, did you guys have a response?
I mean, I feel like that's fair.
We had him behind David Nelson and ahead of Dunlap and Brandon Spikes.
I don't know about ahead of
Brandon Spikes has been terrible, so I don't know how you put Brandon Spikes on the
list. He's been good against the run.
He's always been good against the run.
He's good against, he doesn't play third downs because he's not good, but he's good against the run. He laid some people out on Sunday.
And then poked him in the eye.
Hey, it was one time, man.
I mean, Tim Tebow, the jury's just still out in any form. You can't rank him.
Unless you're talking about fantasy points.
Right, then it's fun. Harvin's a hard guy to rank, too, because of the migraines and that kind of injury concern. But do you guys fine with him at 4? After the big three we talked about, is he the next best guy?
When he plays, he's good.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, it seems like we kind of have a consensus. I mean, the thing that strikes me is that
Mike could easily work his way up that list. I know he's just a rookie right now.
Right,
so.
It's tough to quantify but how good a center is and
trying
to
after 8
games.
I don't
understand
how you don't have Mike Peterson on that list.
Because I'm talking about right now.
He's still in the league.
He's starting middle linebacker for the Atlanta Falcons.
No.
Yes.
Does not Curtis Lofton start at middle linebacker for the Atlanta Falcons?
I do not believe so, sir.
Are you sure? Because Mike Peterson did absolutely nothing this weekend.
He's on the tail end of his career, but it's albeit a darn good career.
No, he had a great career.
He's much worthy of being on any Gators top 10 list than any of these fools that are being listed right now.
He has 8 tackles this season.
Sounds like a top 10 player to me.
Well, yeah, you're just talking about this season. Sure, he's not. Doesn't have the gaudy statistics to put him up there with some of these other guys you want to mention, but he's at the tail end of an amazing career, and it's Mike Peterson.
Right. Yeah, in his heyday, he would be, a couple years ago, he'd be number one on this list, probably.
Right.
So, I mean, you got to factor all this in, but again, we've just kind of give listeners an idea of where the Gators in the NFL are at right now, how we stack them up, so. Productive segment. I think we're about ready to wrap up the show. We have to move into the weekly awards. We have the Ahmad Black Award for Excellence in the Field of Sport and the Will Hill Awful Life Decisions of the Week. We're going to start with the Ahmad. Who wants to go first?
Let Watts go in there.
All right.
Get his golf out of the way.
Let's go. Go ahead. Come on.
The Germinator. Martin Keimer.
God, nobody cares.
Martin Keimer. People care.
I don't even know who that is.
Martin Keimer, he's one of the best golfers in the world. I think he's in the top 3 ranked right now.
And nobody knows who he is.
Nobody cares.
Shut the hell up. Just won the World Golf Championship in Shanghai by birdieing 9 of the last 12 holes. 9 birdies in the last 12 holes to shoot a 63 in the final round of Sunday and win the tournament.
If you want an Ahmad, you have to have like 5 eagles in the last 6 holes or something.
That's absurd. You're losing your mind here.
Not very easy to get an Ahmad if you're a golfer.
9 birdies. To have 9 birdies in one round is amazing. To have 9 birdies
in the last
12
holes. I do that playing Tiger Woods golf all the time.
To win the tournament on Sunday, shooting 63, those are both records, World Golf Championship records.
Okay, cool. It's the World Golf Championship. Tom, what you got?
I'm going to give mine to the Miami Marlins.
Who gives a shit next?
No, I care. It's baseball. People like baseball. Nobody knows about golf.
No. Yeah.
Not the host. Stay over there.
Apparently they're in talks with Jose Reyes. Big free agent. Good to see the Marlins actually going after a big free agent.
I'm interested
once.
In this.
Yeah, I mean, they got that new stadium. Maybe they're going to start doling out cash.
New hats and stuff. All right, well,
Watts is still just bitter because the Braves fell out of the playoffs.
Let's try mine. I'm going to give mine to the Miami Dolphins. Does that meet your stamp of approval?
It's Newsfest.
Matt Moore was awesome. Reggie Bush was awesome. Brandon Marshall was awesome.
Jake
Long told Tom Bahali what's up.
One
was pretty
game
great.
Further away from getting Andrew Luck,
that's not,
which means
that's
the
not
Colts
a,
will be getting him,
that's
so
not
I'm
a,
not happy
That's
about
not
it.
A concern.
It is for me.
Yeah, well, yeah, because Andrew Luck's going to be the next great thing, and everybody's it's going to be awesome, and there's nothing that could go wrong. And he's the next Peyton Manning, so it's just perfect. Let's switch over to the Wills. Watts, going to start us off again?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to go to Mr. Sandusky and Mr. Paterno. I don't
even like to give them the pleasantries of Mr.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really a tragedy in sports, especially one of the most storied programs, that a story like this comes out, and then they've covered up for 15 years, and it just day by day, hour by hour, more and more stuff comes out, and it's just a travesty. And the fact that they let it go on for this long, and that all indications point to Joe Paterno knowing about it and not doing anything about it, just, I mean, it just completely soils his great legacy. It's one of the greatest, most known sports coaches of all time, and now he's going to go down for that.
So, right.
Yeah, and all this, all of his accolades. Yeah, all this stuff comes out a week after he gets the all-time wins record as a head coach.
Right. It's just a travesty.
It's an uncomfortable subject. I really don't want to kind of linger on it, but I mean, if you guys want to hear more about that, there's everybody in the world that's talking about it right
except
now.
For
you
ESPN.
You can find it. It'll be everywhere on the internet, so you can find out more about that way. Tom, what's yours for this week?
That was actually going to be mine. I didn't know Watts was going to go with that, but just so we don't stay on that subject, I'll give my award to the Miami Dolphins
for winning because you want Andrew Luck so bad.
Yes.
I mean, we've had this debate before, and it's stupid. Like, I don't believe that the people who want the Dolphins to lose count as fans.
I don't have a problem with them winning. I just have a problem with them winning when the Colts are still losing.
Well, I mean, this ties into mine, because mine goes to the Colts for being, like, the worst football team I've ever seen. Like, they're so bad. And I think, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the fact that, we've talked about it a little bit before, that the defense is built to play from ahead, and they never get ahead. So, I mean, with Peyton, maybe they could be a halfway decent team, just because everything would be different.
The defense is usually built to play from ahead, but if you look at that defense this year as compared to the defense, even when they won the Super Bowl and even when they weren't winning Super Bowls, the defense was a lot better than it is this
year.
Right.
They still have Freeney and Mathis. They could rush the passer.
They don't have anything in the secondary, though. Right. Nothing. And in this day and age, when you're starting, you know, rookies and second-year guys that are not good in the secondary.
Right. Just between injuries and bad players. You're
small up front, and then you're playing inexperienced guys in the secondary. You can't stop anybody. You can't score points with Curtis Painter. But
what about Dan Orlovsky? UConn great, going to turn some things around.
The arrow is pointing up because they do get the Jags 2 times within the next 5 weeks, I believe it is. So.
Well, I mean, the Jags beat the Ravens, dude. The Colts have no shot against them.
The Jags will lose to the Colts. I promise.
Gator guarantee.
Bold prediction, sir. All right, that about wraps up the show for this week. Send any feedback you have to podcast@alligator.org. You can, until we get back to you next time, you can follow us on Twitter @AlligatorSports. You can follow me @GregLuca.
@ WATTMATTS, Watt Mats.
@TOMAS_VERDE.
You can also find us on Facebook @facebook.com/alligatorpodcast. You can subscribe on iTunes. We are going to be back probably Thursday with the South Carolina preview because we are traveling Friday.
And you can still tweet Matt to try to get a free
Gatorade.
Oh, yeah,
Gatorade's still up for grabs. Surprisingly, nobody hopped on that bandwagon. Maybe we'll consider shipping. I don't know. You can conditionally tweet him.
Yeah, if you're on the way to South Carolina, we'll even make a personal drop-off.
Okay, that's even better. You get to meet your idols there. So that would be fun. But yeah, probably Cody and Tyler in here on Thursday. We might even talk a little hoops with the hoop season about to kick off. We touched a little bit on that last week with the exhibition game fresh in the books. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. We will see you then, and thank you for listening.